This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. In the second half of the show, I'll be joined by Ash Sarkar, and we'll be talking about one of the Tory cabinet ministers suspected of blocking any ban on arms sales to Israel. We'll also look at the incoming Irish Taoiseach, who has some strong words for Benjamin Netanyahu, and we'll discuss Wes Streeting's plans for the NHS. He said some mean things about the left again. So stay tuned for all of that. In the first half, I've got an interview with a really brilliant guest, Daniel Levy. Let's go straight into the first story. Israel has withdrawn almost all its troops from southern Gaza, leaving just one battalion remaining in the Strip. The move came as a surprise on Sunday and led many to initially assume Netanyahu's war might be being scaled back, perhaps on the orders of Joe Biden. However, Israel has quashed any such hope, saying this is merely giving its troops a rest before they mount a renewed offensive on Rafah. In the meantime, thousands of Palestinians who had been sheltering in Rafah have returned to their homes in Khan Yunis. Al Jazeera has reported on what they've found.
For some of the first Palestinians to go back to Khan Yunis, there's not much left that's recognisable. Once home to around 500,000 people, the city in the south of Gaza has been flattened by Israel's military.
The city looks heartbreaking. It's unbelievable. We didn't expect this scale of destruction. There isn't a house without a martyr, wounded or destroyed. Words can't describe it.
Many of the people who've been living in tents or in the open for months on end were hoping there might be some way to start rebuilding their lives.
We came to see what happened to the house, but there weren't any houses here. It's just rubble. You can't live here. Animals can't live here. So how's a person supposed to? The destruction is unreal.
The withdrawal from southern Gaza takes place alongside ongoing negotiations between Israel and Hamas in Cairo. Egyptian media reported this morning that progress had been made towards a ceasefire deal, but that was later contradicted by both Hamas and Israeli officials. The key sticking point, as it has been for months now, is that Israel wants its hostages released in exchange for a temporary ceasefire, while Hamas wants a permanent one. And Netanyahu appears to have no intention of acceding to that demand, in part as it could lead to the end of his premiership. Earlier today, his far-right national security minister tweeted this. So this is from Itamar Ben-Gavir. If the prime minister decides to end the war without an extensive attack on Rafah in order to defeat Hamas, he will not have a mandate to continue serving as prime minister. Now, that seems like a veiled threat. If Netanyahu ends the war, Ben-Gavir's party will leave the governing coalition, and that would cause a collapse in the government and ultimately lead to new elections. Netanyahu is not doing very well in the polls, so that would presumably lead to the end of his stint, his long stint in power. Earlier today, I spoke to Daniel Levy, a British-Israeli analyst who was part of Israel's negotiating team during the Oslo process. I began by asking him how he interprets Israel's withdrawal of troops from southern Gaza.
Is this an occasion where we should take the Israeli leadership at face value? What they're saying is that this division has recycled out of Gaza in preparation for a redeployment, amongst other things, to undertake the long-announced, awaited, and potentially even more devastating operation in Rafah, the ground invasion in Rafah in southern Gaza. I have understood from speaking to people for some time now that for all the talk that Rafah would take place, that this operation will be implemented, that Israel does not have the troops for doing it. So there's a few things to unpack here very briefly. Those troops have been there a long time. They have largely been treading water. There's an acknowledgement, as you can imagine, there's lots of commentary around 6 months. What's the ledger? Let's look at what's going on. A lot of the commentary has been that, other than, which they're not focusing on, the devastating consequences for the Palestinian civilian population, militarily, very little is being achieved by Israel. So one thing is, these people have been there an awfully long time. The Israeli military wants them to get some R&R. And if Israel is going to conduct an operation in Rafah, it would need to do that. It will need to bring new forces in or rest existing forces and then position them back for that operation. Is it, because this is the other interpretation, Michael, which is, I guess, implicit in your question, is this part of a positive signaling towards the US, towards the negotiations taking place with regard to a possible hostage release? I don't think it can be those things if at the same time Netanyahu, the defense minister, and others are insisting that the intention is still to go ahead with the ground operation in Rafah. I do think that the Biden administration is keen, without using further leverage, to be able to say, hey, we got something from the Israelis. So they may well message in that way, but we live in a relatively transparent world. So if they're saying one thing, the Israeli leadership is saying something totally different, I don't think that's going to work out so well.
So I think our audience will understand very clearly why people are concerned about an invasion of Rafah, or deeply concerned about an invasion of Rafah, because you've already got, you know, over a million people in this small space, most of them refugees from the rest of Gaza. The humanitarian consequences would be enormous. I think it's less clear to people potentially why is Israel so obsessed, or why do they see it as so important to go into Rafah? And I know there are divisions potentially within Netanyahu's cabinet, but this seems to be a very sort of high stakes decision. They want to do this. What would they achieve by going into Rafah?
So there's a couple of things here. First of all, in terms of the Israeli narrative to themselves and to their band of supporters and advocates on the outside, who may have shrunk but are still nothing if not shrill and keen to get their message out. To that cohort, this is part of saying we have dismantled Hamas. They argue that the residual Hamas significant sized fighting capacity is in Rafah. And therefore, this mission would be incomplete without doing that. Now, many people look at, as I said, this six-month ledger and say, sure, Hamas certainly had its ranks and its munitions depleted, but it's still there. The idea that there will be total victory is for the birds. It was never going to happen. There will still be armed resistance, but certainly Hamas will exist as a political movement and resistance will continue to exist as an idea. That is the nature of what happens when you keep people without rights and freedoms and you oppress them with a regime of structural violence. But for the Israeli side, the argument is perhaps that if there is an operation in Rafah, then one can move towards a different deployment in Gaza and the winding down of this mission. I'm not hearing people make the argument that one could get the hostages out, really, with an operation in Rafah. You do hear some say the threat of the operation in Rafah could lead to a moderating of the Hamas negotiating position. Of course, they'll hope that if they do a mission in Rafah, they can buy a lottery ticket and finally get some of the Hamas armed wing leadership who they have failed to successfully target in the 6 months of this operation. But, you know, Michael, I think this has become such an issue because they've waited so long on this, and so much of the reality of what has been done to the civil population in Gaza has come out and is slowly being absorbed, even by some of Israel's most diehard supporters. So you have Nancy Pelosi, right, signing a letter along with more of the Democrat congressional folks who you'd expect to sign such a letter saying no more arms from Israel for Israel until we know that they are going to take different measures. So I think this has become such a big deal because it is ever harder not to take very seriously that the South African case in the International Court of Justice of a plausible genocide being committed here is more than just a South African whim. That this is very, very serious. And then there's the final vector that I throw into the equation, which is Benjamin Netanyahu himself. He needs to prolong this war whenever and whatever the day after looks like. It's going to include a lot of him having to be answerable for what happened on October 7th itself, what led up to that. And so he wants this to go on as long as possible. And therefore, actually for him, delaying, waiting, doing rougher in a few more weeks, that's all good. War carries on.
And I suppose that that might feed into sort of an analysis of the negotiations currently taking place in Cairo. So as far as I understand it, there's been very little progress on negotiations, I suppose, ever since that sort of temporary ceasefire towards the end of last year, because you've got these two positions which are completely inconsistent. So Hamas says, we will only release the hostages if we have a permanent ceasefire. Israel says, we want you to release the hostages for a temporary ceasefire, after which we will destroy you. And it seems to be that there has just been no budge from either side. And that's why we're at a sort of complete stalemate. And I mean, there was some sort of, I think the Egyptian media this morning was suggesting, oh, maybe there'd been some progress. And then both Israel and Hamas sort of said, no, there hasn't. I mean, what's your interpretation of what's currently going on in this negotiating room?
I mean, if I could say, Michael, you're one of the few people who seems to have gets it and has just nailed it in the way you phrase that question to me, because that is precisely, it's that disconnect, which you can't play with ambiguity if the Israeli leadership is saying, we are going to continue this. We're not even going to allow the fiction that this can be an on-ramp to a permanent ceasefire. In fact, one would fully expect Netanyahu to announce halfway through such a pause that I'm doing my mobilization. In fact, that's how they've talked about the withdrawal of this division. I'm doing my mobilization for Rafah so that on day 43, no one can be in any doubt that there will be further war. Now, one might expect that the important mediating party when it comes to influencing the Israelis, which is the Biden administration, would put their thumb down on the scale that says, you know, we need this deal. You may not care about the future of the hostages, but we do. You may not care about how long this war goes on. We do. Perhaps because they see the suffering of the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza, more likely because they look at their own polling numbers, not just in Michigan, but elsewhere. And therefore, we are going to bridge that gap. Even if we can't get the Israelis to explicitly say, yes, this is the pathway to a permanent ceasefire, that's how we're going to look at it. And indeed, we will very publicly say that given that this is the pathway to a ceasefire, there is no need for the conveyor belt of weapons and of 2,000-pound bombs and other ordnance and munitions to continue to flow to Israel from the US, without which Israel can continue this military aggression against Gaza. They haven't done that. And I think that, to me, is the missing piece. Now, if they were to do something like that, I think you would finally put in play the fact that the Israeli war cabinet is divided on the question of what priority to accord getting those remaining hostages who are alive out while they still are alive. So you play into a division in the war cabinet, you play into a division inside the military, you play into a division inside the Israeli public, which is more manifest now. The kinds of demonstrations that have been seen in the last days inside Israel have been unprecedented. Thus far, I think what the Americans have done is leaned in just enough to give Bibi something to punch back against, but not leaned in enough to cause Bibi a real headache and to corner him and force a decision within the Israeli polity and public. The other thing I think is important to at least acknowledge is, I think if you get that question of permanent ceasefire versus little pause before more destruction, if you could get that in the right place, in other words, moving to a permanent ceasefire, then I think there are other issues that still need to be closed. What Palestinian prisoners? Who will be released? How many will be released? Thousands more have been arrested in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem during these last 6 months. Will Palestinians be able to return from areas they have been displaced to in the south of Gaza to parts of the northern Gaza, as destroyed as those are? Will Israel redeploy further out of Gaza? Will the humanitarian aid finally get in a significant way? So all of those questions are going to have to be addressed. But unless the overarching question gets properly dealt with, then I do think we'll be stuck. There are more optimistic noises coming out. I hope those turn out to be the case, but we've heard this before, and we're not yet seeing the tipping point.
And let's talk about, I suppose, Israeli politics and how it relates to war aims, because I think there's sort of a dominant narrative emerging in the West that what's happened now, so it was sort of, it was reasonable for Israel to respond with sort of great force to what happened on October the 7th. But what's happened now is that Netanyahu is a little bit out of control. Sort of he's going beyond not only what's reasonable, but beyond what is in the interest of the Israeli state. And he's doing it for political reasons because he wants to stay in power. He's in this fragile coalition. So you've sort of got this out of control leader who's being a bit irrational. And you've got these moderates in Israel who sort of want to get rid of him, and if only those moderates were to win. Now, I kind of have a suspicion that something else might be going on, which is that, you know, the moderate forces in Israel might be really pleased that Netanyahu is changing facts on the ground, completely destroying any capacity that Hamas had, completely sort of destroying lives and livelihoods in Gaza, making it, I suppose, lowering the negotiating power of any Palestinian, whoever takes charge in Gaza. And then they get to take over afterwards and say, oh, the horrible bits, that was Netanyahu. But we're here to sort of try and rebuild, but sort of knowing, nod, nod, wink, wink, that they were, you know, really cheering on the fact that the entire Gaza Strip was being destroyed.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. I do think there is a narrative that is very convenient, but also bears little relationship to reality in terms of, you know, this is all about Bibi, bad Bibi, and if only we could get rid of him, then sanity will prevail. That's not the way, unfortunately, Israeli politics plays out at the moment. So, first of all, they're not, it's not like they're keeping shtum. It's not like they're staying silent and saying, yeah, let Bibi do all the bad stuff. Almost the entirety of the political establishment, the entirety of the Jewish Israeli Zionist political establishment has been behind this. Let's not forget that it was the president, President Herzog, former leader of the Labour Party, who very early on said there are no civilians, there's no distinction here. He was the one who the International Court of Justice, in laying down one of its provisional measures, quoted, basically saying this guy's inciting to genocide, he should be on trial, which hasn't happened. Now, I do think that there's a division now over whether Israel can carry on with a military operation that is increasingly treading water, that is not securing its military goals. You know, there's lots of other things going on in terms of moral turpitude, legal turpitude, what Israel's doing to those different equities. There is still the very real prospect that this could spread regionally after yet another very significant Israeli provocation on a diplomatic posting of Iran in Damascus, the Syrian capital. So there are those other things going on. From day one, Israel announced that food, fuel, water, and electricity would be closed off to the Palestinian population. So the idea that you were just targeting Hamas was never really something that was either stated. Since the ICJ case began, they've had to be a bit more careful about what they say, but it's not something that was stated or practiced. I recommend people read the piece in the Israeli news website, 972 magazine, about this AI targeting tool, Lavender, that Israel has used, which has allowed for an incredibly broad definition in terms of who could be classed as Hamas-affiliated and therefore a target, how they could be pursued, how drone destruction could be used against innocent Palestinians. All of which means that we are now at a place where, as you suggest, there are some Israeli political forces who did not oppose what has gone on. They haven't been calling for an end to the destruction. Some may have said prioritize the hostages. They haven't been speaking differently about this plausible genocide, but who are now saying elections bring this operation to a close. And I guess the question is, are they offering a different future? Are they offering a way forward with the Palestinians that's different? And that I'm genuinely devastated by this. The really sad thing is that across the Zionist political spectrum in Israel, no one is saying that. You basically have apartheidists with a smiling face who are saying, let's go back to the status quo ante. Maybe we'll talk to the Palestinian Authority, which is totally compromised and largely works for Israeli security rather than representing Palestinian interests. Through to those to Bibi's right in his coalition, these characters, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who we're familiar with, who openly call for further displacement, dispossession, eradication. And Bibi kind of tactically maneuvers between those two positions. You don't have anyone who is getting anywhere close to talking the language of before October 7th, there were these root causes there, however they would want to describe it, but there was this issue that was unaddressed and that now needs to be addressed. Where that leaves us is also with what you said, which is the level of devastation, the level of displacement, the level of intentional, premeditated collapse of the infrastructure in Gaza. It means that whenever the guns do fall silent, Gaza doesn't suddenly become inhabitable, livable in. I mean, there was close on two decades of a blockade before October 7th, right? Now we've seen the entire hospital system collapse, destroyed, devastated, the schools, government offices. And my familiarity with the Israeli system is not only for some, this means that even if the guns fall silent, the push to get people to physically leave Gaza will still be a very live, palpable thing. But it also means that other Israeli politicians, like those who were in power briefly for a year when Bibi was out, these people familiar with the names, Lapid, Gantz, nominally leaders of an opposition, if one can call it that, they will look at this and say, well, we can keep the international community, our Western allies, etc., busy, and some of the Arab states who are willing to play ball, busy with the reconstruction of Gaza. And we, you know, one day we can be super generous about what we let in and maybe some rubble clearing equipment and maybe some things that we previously listed as dual use. My goodness, what largesse on our part. And then sometimes we'll be a bit tough and keep everyone focused on this thing, so that what's going on in the West Bank and the continued dispossession and removal of Palestinians and allowing the settlers to run amok continues over there.
And so, I suppose you've spoken to it a little bit there, but we're 6 months into this war, and I feel like at the beginning of it, people were talking about sort of possible outcomes, you know, what they could see happen. Obviously, sort of on the far right of Israeli politics, and I think probably what, you know, Netanyahu's ideal was for everyone to leave, you know, to sort of create such a crisis that the international community would say, okay, yeah, we're going to pay Egypt to let the Gazans in and basically depopulate the strip. That doesn't seem to be happening. What will they try and do? Like, they'll have depleted Hamas, then they bring in the Palestinian Authority, they sort of get the Gulf states to put some money. I still don't see an outcome that makes sense, you know, that seems in any way sustainable. Or I suppose, are you sort of saying maybe that's the point, that you sort of have Gaza as this open sore that distracts everyone while Israel does what it really wants, which is just expand its territory in the West Bank?
So first of all, if you have no intention of allowing something that anyone would see as approximating giving the Palestinians their rights, something that's actually a Palestinian state, not a Lego toy version of a state, not, to call it by a slightly more political and accurate term, the kind of Bantustan homeland that existed under apartheid South Africa. Transkei, Ciskei, Maputo, Tswana, these were things, these were places. They even claimed that, no, we're independent, you should recognize us. So given that Israel, again, pretty much across the political spectrum, has no intention of this happening, other than if you are a member of that kind of Ben-Gvir, Smotrich cohort, you're not going to be saying openly to the world, look, you know, this is what we have in mind. So are you going to come along with us? You're our friends. You should. So instead, they've played this game, this Potemkin peace process game. Given that they've got nothing really to put on the table in that game, and given that for Netanyahu, the continuation of the war is part of his own political survival, even by Israeli standards, there has been a real dearth of this is what's on the table. And so when Israel's allies have tried to fill that gap and said, well, why don't we bring the PA in? What about an Arab force? Israel has been divided on how to respond to that, okay? And Netanyahu has largely rejected those things. But I do think that you're right. There isn't a plan for the day after. I think the reality is that we will muddle through. I think a lot of what is being suggested by outside powers is either painfully naive and learning nothing from the lessons of this peace process that we have been in for three decades, and which expired a quarter of a century ago. That was the timeline for Oslo, finish everything by May 1999. Either they're painfully naive and they've learned nothing, or there is an intentional sleight of hand here that when they talk about this time we're serious about a peace process, let's go back to strengthening the Palestinian Authority. We might even recognize a Palestinian state. What this is really is an attempt to cut the difference, split the difference with the Israelis and say, okay, you won't say state, we'll say state. We both know that what we're talking about is essentially a refreezing of the status quo ante, which I think very credibly has been referred not only by human rights organizations as one meeting the legal definition of apartheid, but also in their presentations to the International Court of Justice in the other case, which looks at Israel's permanent occupation. 25 states have referred to as an apartheid reality. So I think that is what they're trying to counter-funnel the Palestinians back into. Two key things in that respect. One is the Palestinian political collapse, that you can only make progress on that if you have a Palestinian political address appointed by the outside that has no legitimacy or credibility with its own people. And that's the state of the Palestinian Authority today. So I think any attempt to put that back in Gaza is really an attempt to continue the status quo and make Gaza part of this Bantustan reality. So that's the Palestinian piece of it. And then the other is the Arab states. And can you get them to go along? And here opinion is divided. Obviously, some of them have preemptively normalized with Israel and might be happy to go along with that. I think with everything that's going on and where you see where Arab opinion is at, that's going to be hard to pull off and something that even those states are not kind of queuing up to sign on to.
That was Daniel Levy speaking to me earlier today. I'm now joined by Ash Sarkar. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And since, I think it was just before we went live actually, so after I spoke to Daniel Levy, Netanyahu has given a video address where he has said that Israel will go into Rafah, and he says there is a date. Now, you know, saying that, I mean, it's just repeating what I suppose he has been saying for a while. There is one theory that he's saying this just to sort of increase his bargaining power at negotiations. Ash, though, it does seem like the Israelis do want to go into Rafah with all the sort of humanitarian consequences that will have.
One of the really key questions for me, and this isn't something that I have an answer to, is to what extent is Netanyahu thinking in a sort of short to medium term about how he wants this war to go, and how much is he having to think on a day-to-day, week-to-week kind of schedule for his own political survival, because I think that's really quite important when you're trying to think about what's going to happen next. What I think you can say in terms of his own priorities is that when international pressure is weighed up against the sort of domestic political pressures of having to keep the army on side, the far-right members of his cabinet like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, ultimately it's been those domestic pressures which have won out. And that's because, as Daniel Levy says, there is a great deal of political consensus for the war in Gaza, for the obliteration of living infrastructure in Gaza, and for there to be a completely indiscriminate use of firepower against Palestinian civilians. That is a mainstream political opinion in Israeli politics. So if I was a betting woman, I would perhaps say that once more, those domestic political pressures will win out. But when you are seeing such a shift in, what is the pro-Israeli political tradition in the United States, when you're seeing such a shift when it comes to things like immediate ceasefire, looking at arms sales, maybe that could be enough to apply pressure. I would perhaps think that Netanyahu would bank on the assumption that this is saber rattling from the United States and are actually willing to follow through with any reduction in military aid or any proper examination of weapon sales. There might be some kind of promise of a review, but that's the kind of thing that you can quite easily kick into the long grass, as we saw with our own promised review back in 2014. So I think maybe Netanyahu says, okay, America's a paper tiger. They can't really stop us from invading Rafah. And this is going to be the thing which extends my premiership that little bit longer.
I mean, I would add sort of one more variable, which is I'm still not even sure if the Americans don't want the Israelis to go into Rafah, right? I suppose I was asking Daniel Levy a similar question about sort of the so-called centrists in the Israeli political establishment. Are they actually quite keen for Netanyahu to go do the unpopular thing, sort of them say, oh, our hands are clean of this, but he changes the facts on the ground, damages Hamas more, kills a lot more Palestinians, kills more Palestinian infrastructure, or you don't kill infrastructure, destroys more Palestinian infrastructure. And then the Americans said, well, we did ask him not to do it. Because I think if they genuinely didn't want to do it, want him to do it, then they could stop sending weapons, or they could unite with other countries on the Security Council and pass a proper motion calling for a ceasefire. Not abstain and then claiming it's not legally binding, which is what they did the last time. So I'm suspicious if, just like some of the Israeli politicians like to say, oh, this is Netanyahu's war, but we'll just, we'll take advantage of what he's achieving for us. I think the Americans might be doing the same.
Well, what I'd say in terms of America, and this is different from how, more centrist political figures and parties will be thinking about this in Israel, is that I think it's quite plausible that the calculation being made by Israeli political parties and figures is let Netanyahu be the bad guy, do the thing that we don't want to do ourselves, but we actually want to happen. I think with, the US, I think that there is sincerity in not wanting a ground invasion of Rafah, but they don't want that as much as they want an ally in the region. They don't want that as much as they want, a bulwark against Iran. They don't want that as much as they want to keep arming Israel as what, the Western powers of old used to call a mini Ulster, a mini Jewish Ulster that could be a bastion of Western interests in the region. So I think that that's a bit different from Israel doing what America really wants them to do, but wants to preserve some kind of, moral veneer. I think, they'd prefer if they didn't invade Rafah, but they don't want it enough as much as they want the other stuff. And who pays the price for that? Of course, the Palestinians.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put. I suppose two theories there. And either way, the consequence for Gazans is probably going to be very similar, and very similar in sort of depressing and deadly way. And we're going to move on to the politics of this in the UK. Rishi Sunak and David Cameron are facing pressure from within cabinet to not put any conditions on arms sales to Israel. That was according to Bloomberg, who last week reported Cameron and Sunak are caught in between opposing Tory factions. The Bloomberg report said there were three cabinet ministers in particular who were very pro-Israel, very, very much opposed to conditioning military aid. Bloomberg didn't say who they were, but comments from former Minister Alan Duncan last week gave an indication that it could include Michael Gove and Oliver Dowden. And it was Oliver Dowden who spoke to Laura Koonsberg on Sunday on the government's behalf. This was his answer as to whether Britain should suspend Israeli arms sales.
The kind of relish with which people are rushing towards this question without understanding the broader context. It's right to raise individual issues, but you have to see it in this wider context of the challenge that Israel faces.
It's interesting you say that. You've said twice, actually, that Israel is being held to extremely high standards. And you've just said you think some people are relishing sort of putting Israel on the spot over whether or not they're acting legally. Who do you think's relishing that? Don't you think people are just asking questions based on what they see as appalling suffering in Gaza? Who do you think is relishing it?
Well, I think this is an important point, which is that I think it's all too easy for the world to forget the horrors that Israel faced and rush back to attacking Israel and holding Israel to standards that we wouldn't remotely hold other countries to. Now, it's right that we hold Israel to those highest standards. No, because Israel is a democratic country. It's a rules-based country. It's a part of our broader Western family of nations.
Well, it's a rules-based country. Now, after the ICJ ruled that Israel is potentially committing genocide and gave them a bunch of conditions they had to abide by, a senior cabinet minister tweeted, "Hague Schmeg," right? It's not really a country that's committed to the rule of law. I also love it when we're supposed to take context into account, right? So if you talk about October the 7th, you say, we have to look at the context of this, you know, not to justify what was done, but we have to look at the context. Oh, no, that's defending terrorism. And you got this conservative on the BBC saying, oh, yes, you know, they might be killing 33,000 Palestinians. They might be on trial at the International Court of Justice, but we need to look at the context here. Suddenly context is relevant. Ash, the discussion I wanted to have here, and I think it's sort of an interesting one, is there is a divide. We talk a lot on this show about sort of divides within the left, but there is also a divide within conservatism and within the right, I think, between neoconservatives and traditional conservatives. I was actually talking to Peter Oborne about this the other day for my podcast, and sort of he thinks of himself as a Burkean conservative, where conservatism is about, you know, keeping things somewhat as they are, right? Not doing anything too hasty. And then you've got a traditional conservative might be somewhat sort of, habitually isolationist, you know, let's not get involved because it all could go very, very wrong. And then a neoconservative is almost the precise opposite, the sort of megalomaniac, we can transform the world in our image, and also very Manichaean, so sort of good versus evil. George W. Bush is probably, you know, when people think of neoconservatives, they'll think of George W. Bush and the Bush administration. They saw the world as sort of this fight between good and evil, the evil being sort of the Islamist fundamentalists and the good being the Western countries. And that image took them to very revolutionary positions in a way, which was trying to overthrow governments here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, not just to say, oh, because we want to protect our business interests in sort of like a more Cold War fashion, but because we want to transform them from the bottom up. And I think what we might be seeing here is a division within the Conservative Party between the neocons, especially Michael Gove. So sort of he was a big deal in Policy Exchange. I think he's somewhat close to the Henry Jackson Society, though I'd need to look that one up. But that sort of comes to my mind when I think about him. And then I think Oliver Dowden is sort of in that crew as well. You've got these neocons who, when they look at Israel, they see Israel, West, Hamas, barbarist, East, and then whatever Israel does, they say, well, this is between good and evil, and the good side is Israel. And so they're more willing to do whatever Israel wants, Israel's bidding, than maybe the traditional conservatives who are a bit sort of like, well, you know, we want to balance our interests in the Middle East.
Well, I might surprise you here, because this is where Oliver Dowden is completely right. And this is where I think you're a bit mistaken in your rebuttal of what he was saying. Is Israel part of the Western family of nations? And is what Israel is doing in line with how, you know, Western powers like the US and Britain have conducted themselves in recent decades? Well, the answer is yes. The answer is 100% yes. And when you look at the kind of language that Israel is using, referring to Palestinian prisoners in Gaza who have been reporting extensive use of torture, referring to them as unlawful combatants, that is exactly the framework that was used by America when they were talking about individuals who were detained at Guantanamo Bay and trying to explain why the rules of war pertaining to the treatment of prisoners of war didn't apply to them. So I think if you want to, you know, look at what Israel is doing in Gaza, not simply in terms of what Israel wants to do in terms of expanding its territory and eradicating the Palestinian people from that land, if you look at it within the context of the war on terror, military practices, legal practices, you know, these are things which have been nurturing each other for a really long time. Israel is borrowing from the war on terror play, and in turn, the architects of the war on terror saw Israel as essential to its interests in the region. Now, one of the things that I would say is that actually the Manichaean quality of good versus evil that was present in the war on terror, that actually was a continuation from the Cold War, because the Cold War gave America a tremendous sense of global purpose. And not just that, the Cold War was a reason to have such a, you know, highly developed military industrial complex with defense contractors, weapons manufacturers making absolute bank. Now, after the end of the Cold War, there was, you know, a so-called peace dividend. There were being cuts made to the Department of Defense, and America was having to think about what its new, you know, global status would be. Was it going to be backed up by aircraft carriers, or was it going to be diplomacy? And after 9/11, there was a pretext for doing a lot of things that neoconservatives had wanted to do for a very long time. So yes, there was the invasion of Afghanistan. Following on from that, of course, was the invasion of Iraq, which, you know, very shortly after 9/11, you had senior neocons and policymakers and influential figures in Washington saying that they wanted to do. Right, the WMD stuff was padded on as a pretext, using, you know, confected and unreliable intelligence. A lot of it coming from, you know, Iraqi dissidents who were moving in those policymaking circles in Washington and in Westminster. And, you know, their real goal was to go for Iran as well. And they couldn't do it. They couldn't, you know, after the disasters of Afghanistan and Iraq, absolutely couldn't get together the kind of buy-in or political consensus or public support for an invasion of Iran. But make no mistake, that is what many of these people wanted to do. And so when it comes to Israel and what Israel is up to, which is, you know, one, it's seen as a kind of bulwark in this clash of civilizations between, you know, the democratic West and the barbarous Muslim East, but also these provocative actions of Israel, such as, you know, bombing the consulate in Damascus, the Iranian consulate. That gets many of these neocons thinking about, could this be a pretext to achieve some of those strategic objectives that they wanted to way back in 2001? And so if you define a Western family of nations, not by what I think it should be defined as, which is, you know, rule of law, international cooperation and democracy, but by flouting international law, but, you know, coming up with legal frameworks which completely override the Geneva Convention, you know, coming up with, you know, good versus evil stories in order to, you know, make essentially, you know, millions of people in the Middle East considered fair game. If you want to construct this category of unlawful combatants, Israel is doing that and doing it very, very well. So that is where Oliver Dowden, I think, is speaking with a degree of honesty, if not candor.
I suppose to go back to sort of the point I was making before, because yes, I don't think what Israel are doing is alien to sort of Western foreign policies, but sort of the examples you were using to sort of compare to Israel were the neocons, right? So the war on terror was conducted by neocons. So I suppose I'm saying Oliver Dowd and Michael Gove, George W. Bush, these are the neocons who are sort of exceptionally ideological when it comes to foreign policy with a Manichaean vision. And then you can also have conservatives who are a bit more realist, you know, so they're about defending the national interest, but they don't necessarily see there being this sort of huge clash of civilizations, which I think is what was sort of quite, you know, particular potentially to the neocons. Because I mean, you can look at sort of governments in the West who aren't so sort of gung-ho in terms of sort of getting involved and trying to completely radically transform the world. So there will be administrations that are a bit more small C conservative than Israel's current one, or George W. Bush's, or what Michael Gove or Oliver Dowden would probably like to see.
Well, also one of the things that Western countries should have learned is that the adventurous warfare of the war on terror did not make people in Europe or America safer. I mean, one, you had like a completely heightened sense of paranoia in America, which, you know, lasted for decades. But two, you did have terrorist attacks on European soil and on British soil, which were a direct consequence of our military activities overseas. I mean, one of the outcomes of ousting Saddam Hussein was the rise of ISIS. So I think that there has been a shift amongst other European powers away from that sort of neoconservative model. But in Westminster, there's a sort of odd political culture. There are, you know, significant numbers of politicians, policymakers, and journalists who have never forgiven the left for being right about Iraq, never forgiven the left for it. And ultimately, what they want to do is a chance to do it all again, I think, just because they don't like the people who are telling them that was a terrible idea in the first place. And it is that petty. So I think, yes, there are these, you know, hardcore ideologues, Oliver Dowden, Michael Gove being two of them. But I also think there is the softer outer ring of people who just never really liked anti-war protesters and who would help sleepwalk the UK into another disastrous Middle Eastern intervention if they could.
I am now trying to sort of, in the back of my mind, desperately think of a conservative who hasn't had a sort of very interventionist foreign policy. If you can think of one, you know, in either the US or the UK, do let us know in the comments. Otherwise, I'll be putting this out to Twitter this evening. We can, though, find you a conservative that isn't supporting Israel in any kind of gung-ho way. Fine Gael in Ireland are a centre-right party. They're currently in power in coalition with Fianna Fáil. Now, their new leader, Simon Harris, is due to become Ireland's next Taoiseach. That's after Leo Varadkar's resignation. And he said this on the weekend.
So what we've seen happen in Gaza and the actions of the Israeli government is utterly reprehensible. It's appalling and it's grotesque. We are seeing children being maimed and killed, innocent children. It is disgusting, it is despicable, and it must stop. This country, Ireland, and a government that I intend to lead will always speak truth to power, just like our Taoiseach Leo Varadkar did in the White House to President Biden only in recent weeks. There needs to be an immediate ceasefire. The attack on aid workers was particularly, in my view, callous and chilling, and we will continue to call that out. We also, as a country, stand ready to play our part in a political process that brings about a two-state solution. This country, and indeed the UK, know a lot about the importance of peace processes. This ultimately requires a political solution that delivers a two-state solution.
Ash, lots of people have been very impressed by statements from Irish politicians since October the 7th. The Irish and the Spanish are the two nations who in Europe have been most supportive of the Palestinians or resistant to, you know, the completely out of control Israelis. Any analysis of why that might be the case? I mean, I suppose Ireland has a history of resisting colonial occupation. Spain, less so, I would have thought. What's your take?
Well, if you want a really thorough analysis of why Ireland does have this sense of affinity with the Palestinian cause, you could do a lot worse than listening to my downstream interview with Blind Boy of Blind Boy Boat Club fame. And one of the things that he talked about is that, yes, you do have this resonance, this sense of shared experience that comes from having been colonized, having been cast as terrorists, having been cast as ungrateful, biting the hand that feeds, as being cast as, you know, the people who cannot be partners for peace. So there are these sort of narrative resonances between the Irish experience and the Palestinian cause. But there's also some really, you know, direct connections. So, this was the fact that Blind Boy taught me, which was Cara Delevingne's great grandfather, who founded the Black and Tans, who were, of course, you know, just war criminals roaming around Ireland, had been in Palestine putting down the Arab Revolt, which was, you know, absolutely bloody, nefarious business. The vision for Israel was very similar to the vision for Ulster, as I mentioned earlier on in the show. I mean, many of the people who were integral to the eventual partition plan, you know, integral to the Balfour Declaration even, were also integral to the, you know, oppression and suppression of Irish political and civil rights. So I think that that's one of the reasons why it's felt so strongly. It's not just a case of, okay, narratively, there are these similarities. It's like, well, no, our history is connected by this shared personnel. Why it's the case in Spain, I couldn't tell you, but I'd be really interested to know.
I was just looking through some of the comments, suggestions as to right-wing people who might have a genuinely sort of conservative foreign policy in the sense of not wanting to, you know, constantly throw grenades and sort of radically transform different societies. I mean, even David Davis, although I did just Google, he did vote for the Iraq War, apparently. And then Crispin Blunt, who does say some pretty reasonable things on Palestine, at least. I want one who's been in power. So I want a conservative who's been in power in sort of a Western nation and hasn't been sort of radically gung-ho when it comes to foreign interventions. I suppose Jacques Chirac in France is an option. But I don't know much about him. Maybe that was, you know, maybe that was specific to Iraq and actually he was quite gung-ho elsewhere.
I've also got a controversial one.
Go on.
A really controversial one. So Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's got some small C conservatist, realist. I'm not out to radically transform the world. We're just going to protect American interests. Don't bother starting idealistic wars. True. The danger with Donald Trump is he might also be the one who creates sort of the war to end all wars by pressing the nuclear button at some point. So he's a bit
because
erratic,
he might just feel like it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but he definitely does.
He might
lean
just
into
feel like it one day.
He definitely does lean into conservative isolationism. I think that's sort of like a tradition he actively flirts with. I'll have to keep this one on the back burner. I think this distinction between sort of neoconservative conservatives and traditional conservatives definitely exists in ideology. I'm trying to work out if it does really exist in practice as well. And let's go on to our final story of the day. The NHS won't get extra money unless it reforms. That's the message from Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting, who has written this in The Sun. If the NHS doesn't change, it will die. For the Conservatives, the NHS is covered in flashing signs warning, danger, do not touch. They know the public don't trust them with it, so they daren't change it. Only Labour can reform the NHS. It won't happen overnight. It will take a decade of change and modernisation to make the NHS fit for the future. Now, this is really interesting, I thought, from Wes Streeting. So there's a sort of a theory in political science and political sociology which says it's easier to do a right-wing policy if you're a left-wing party, or a right-wing, or a left-wing policy, sorry, if you're a right-wing party. So it's called the Nixon goes to China theory. So the argument goes that the reason Richard Nixon was able to make peace with China in the 1970s was because he was seen as a very right-wing president. So he essentially had permission to do it. It would have potentially been very damaging for a Democrat to go to China because they would have been called soft on communism. But because no one suspected Richard Nixon of being a communist, he could go and meet Mao, right? So background here, America used to recognize Taiwan as the real China for a couple of decades. Very ridiculous policy, ended in the 1970s. The theory, the Nixon goes to China theory, says that this can apply to many things. So people look at the 90s and they say the reason why Bill Clinton and Schroeder in Germany were able to introduce labor reforms was because, you know, they were considered to be of the left, so they could introduce right-wing policies and people would think, oh, that's not them being ideological, that's them being pragmatic, whereas Streeting seems to be explicitly saying it's only going to be the Labour Party who are able to introduce the kind of privatizing reforms, the kind of marketization that people would be very suspicious of the Conservatives if they were to do it. It's an interesting argument. It might be worrying to you if you don't want to see the marketization of the NHS. The reforms Streeting talks about include more routine operations on the weekend, collaboration with tech entrepreneurs, and using spare capacity in the private sector. He also made a jab at the people he thinks might oppose his plans. Middle-class lefties cry betrayal. The real betrayal is the two-tier system that sees people like them treated faster, while working families like mine are left waiting for longer. Very interesting. Working-class families like mine. Now, he's on a decent income. So he's sort of saying, why should I have to use the NHS when all you middle class lefties go and use private? Now, not many people in this country do use private. It is growing because the NHS is such a state. But sort of the idea that all of these people who are, quite protective of the NHS are on the side going and using private healthcare. I'm not sure I really buy that argument. Anecdotally, that's not the kind of people I meet who are campaigning for the NHS. And Wes Streeting explained a bit more about his thinking on Good Morning Britain.
Labour's already made some significant commitments for additional investment, but in every single case, that investment is linked to reform. So because we know that action is needed to cut waiting lists, and some hospitals have shown us how to do that with clinics that work at evenings and weekends, albeit with a cost attached because you have to pay staff fairly, obviously, to do that work. We've committed £1.1 billion to cut NHS waiting lists, providing 2 million appointments a year to get those waiting lists down. But that's linked to the reform element of extra evening and weekend working. On mental health, where we've committed £750 million to make sure that we address the mental health crisis, particularly affecting young people, that's not just more money for the existing system. It's new services, making sure that we get to young people sooner through support in every primary and secondary school and community mental health hubs in every community. And even on scanners, where we've committed to double the number of diagnostic CT and MRI scanners over the course of the parliament, that's not just more scanners, it's AI-enabled scanners so that we can diagnose faster and more accurately, getting more people diagnosed because you can do more scans. So that investment is also linked to reform. And that's the argument I'm making to the NHS and actually to the country, because we want a mandate for this reform.
I'm not sure this makes much sense. So what I was saying before, and I think is the argument he's making in The Sun, obviously to a very right-wing readership, right? He's saying, we will be trusted to do the kind of reforms that the Conservatives couldn't get away with. Now, the only kind of reforms that Labour might be trusted to do that the Tories wouldn't be are, say, marketisation, right? Because when the Tories do it, everyone says they're privatising the NHS. When Labour does it, they can say, we're improving standards in the NHS. And to be honest, I mean, historically, when New Labour did it, they were often, it was part and parcel of a package which did improve the NHS. And when the Tories do it, it is part and parcel of a package which is making it worse. So it's not completely unreasonable. But the idea that these controversial reforms, which only a Labour Party would be able to introduce, are more mental health services and more scanners that use AI. You know, that there is no one in this country who is saying, oh, I wouldn't trust the Tories to introduce more scanners. I'm only going to trust the Labour Party to introduce new scanners. So it seems to me that he's not really laying his cards on the table there. He says, we're going to do difficult reform, like introduce scanners with AI. You know, I don't think you're going to get sort of, walkouts in the NHS because you've got all these radiologists saying, we want to make sure no AI can be used in the NHS so that we can keep our jobs checking whether people have cancer or broken bones, right? Pretty much everyone working in the NHS is saying, we are massively under capacity. We're overworked. We need something to take the strain off us. I think they're going to welcome AI when it comes to scans. Now, we've discussed sort of AI and healthcare on this show before. There are many parts of the healthcare system where it doesn't seem it will be that transformative, because so much of the healthcare system is about human to human contact and care, which you cannot replace with a machine. I do think that the scanning, so scanning for cancer, particularly cancer, right? Because AI, I think, is potentially already better than a human doctor at working out what may or may not be cancer. I think at the moment, you still need a doctor to sort of sign it off. You won't be diagnosed by a computer, but in terms of picking out where there might be cancer, I do think AI is better than the naked eye. I've digressed a little bit. Ash, give me your comments on Wes Streeting after me babbling for about 10 minutes there.
All this man knows how to do is punch left and talk shit. And lo and behold, he's done both again. I mean, this first thing about, you know, middle-class lefties who, you know, sneak off and use private healthcare. I mean, that's just a complete straw man. And secondly, when he then starts talking about these planned reforms, there's nothing that the left or, you know, the doctors or nurses unions are going to get particularly up in arms about. Really, I think what he's talking about is the idea of, you know, further marketization and privatization. And is that something he's willing to do because he's the authentic working class and everyone else is just a middle-class hypocritical virtue signaler? Or is it because he accepted political donations from people with stakes in private healthcare? I don't know. Why don't you tell me which sounds more plausible? I mean, I also object to the idea that there are certain reforms that the Tories just wouldn't be able to do. Because particularly if you look at the time period of 1997 to the present day, I would say probably the biggest package of reforms that came into the NHS were the Andrew Lansley reforms as part of David Cameron's government. So I don't think it's the case that that was an area that the Tories really feared to tread. It's just that after that time period, they were having to deal with the consequences of their disastrous reforms and underfunding. And I think also the long tail of some of those new Labour reforms that you were making reference to. So this thing of, you know, Labour's reforms were part of a package to improve the NHS and they were trusted with it. I think one of the things that you need to remember about Tony Blair's approach to the NHS is that he was trying to increase spending without fucking with the tax burden. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you had these PFI contracts, which overall became really expensive and in some cases failed to deliver much needed maintenance and upkeep and building works to the NHS estate. You know, in the long run was more expensive, but in your sort of like day-to-day expenses, they're like, okay, this is a cheaper way of getting money into the NHS. My argument for that would be, sure, it had those short to medium terms, you know, positive impacts on the NHS, but on the longer term is left us with some very expensive problems to solve. So I would quibble with, you know, the Nixon goes to China analogy here, particularly because of Andrew Lansley, and also the characterization of New Labour's reforms to the NHS. Don't get me wrong, increased spending, very, very good. Decreased waiting lists and waiting times, very, very good. But ultimately, I would say that PFI was a very, very bad thing for the NHS.
Well, we're going to go to someone who really knows what he's talking about when it comes to the NHS. We're going to go to the expert. It's the leader of the Reform Party, Richard Tice. They're pledging an extra £17 billion a year for the health service. And this is how Richard Tice said they'd pay for it.
The annual cost to the taxpayer of net zero is over £30 billion. One of our policies is to scrap net zero. That provides the money. The other key area...
How does it provide the money?
Because that's the money that the government is currently spending of taxpayers' funds in the public sector on trying to achieve net zero, which will make no difference to climate change. And what I'm saying is I think the British public would rather zero waiting lists in 2 years than zero CO2 in 25 years.
Polling suggests that the British public are broadly
because the British public haven't been told of the cost. They haven't been told of the cost, which is over £30 billion of taxpayers' cash every year. And we've got a healthcare crisis, we've got a staffing crisis, we've got an A&E crisis, we've got an excess deaths crisis, all because we're not getting on top of these waiting lists.
So Richard Tice, they're saying net zero will have nothing to do with climate. I think he is a bit of a climate skeptic in general. Ash, this doesn't strike me as the way to save the NHS, to sort of say, screw climate change. I'm sure lots of people would also quibble with his £30 billion figure. I was looking at this today, sort of what is supposed to be the cost of net zero. There was, from the Office for Budget Responsibility in 2021, I think they said it was going to cost £20 billion a year. But lots of that was actually just from lost petrol tax, which we wouldn't necessarily think of that as being a cost to government, because it just means people have to pay less petrol tax. We just tax something else, I suppose. But what do you make of that? Electorally, I can see what he's thinking. People like the NHS, and there are, you know, actually in general, net zero is somewhat popular, but there is a section of society who are getting increasingly concerned about it, in part because of GB News and people sort of spreading fear about it. But he's saying NHS good, climate change bad. That's the sort of segment they've decided to appeal to in the electorate. Will it work?
Well, it's not too dissimilar from the Brexit campaign of 2016, which was EU bad, you can get rid of all this waste, and then you can put all that money into the NHS. Now, we left the EU. Did we get £300 million a week for the NHS? Fuck no. So I think
apparently we did actually, but that was only
harder.
Because of COVID. Sorry. So well, what they always say is we did actually increase it by £300 million, but that was just to pay for all the tests and trays and everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were also some downsides to the pandemic, so I hear. I mean, increased funding for the NHS per week, great. Loads of dead people, well, not so good. But I think it's hard to make the same line stick twice, right? So it's like, all right, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. And I also think that there's something, I don't know, given enough time and given enough funding, you know, the leaving the EU position went from something very, very fringe to actually happening. And I think one of the things that it did is that it tapped into that vein of Euroscepticism, which was always strong in this country, but which had been accommodated by the sort of half in, half out position that we had with the EU anyway. You know, we didn't have to join a single currency, didn't have to join Schengen. You know, we had those opt-outs. They were able to tap into something which was already there. In terms of the net zero stuff, there isn't particularly strong antipathy towards net zero. What there is strong antipathy towards an increased tax burden or other, you know, hikes in household costs. So that's not quite as direct as, you know, tapping into a well of established Euroscepticism, but it could be done. And with a media machine behind you, you know, you've got money and airtime on your side. There's something instinctive in me saying that it's a harder story to really nail.
I mean, it's also a harder sort of, it's not a referendum, is it? So, the Brexit Party are not going to become the opposition after the next election. Sort of, we are in a two-party system. Although, if you can vote a Green candidate in Bristol, I would say go for it. Ash, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. I don't know if you could hear, but my cat is wailing outside the door, wanting to get in after wailing at me to let him out during the Daniel Levy interview. So I'm going to go out and give him a stern talking to.
Yeah, not remotely acceptable, I'm afraid. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.